You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT. Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to another edition of Radio MMT. You're here this week with Katie and Kev again. How are you, Katie?
I'm excellent, thank you, Kev.
And welcome to our listeners for another show. Very glad that you're with us. We did a show, the last show we did, Katie, and we both came out and went, oh, we just touched on something there. We actually need to expand. We sort of scratched the surface on things and came out and thought, look, no, we really need to go into what we said last week a bit more. And essentially, it's about what the world needs to do to face some of the crises that it's facing, in particular the environmental crisis, and how that situation has arisen through capitalism, neoliberal capitalism in particular. And so we kind of know what we need to do, but then we're having a look at what's actually happening. That's the kind of premise for the show. That's what we scratched on last time. And so we're just going to unpack that a bit more. What do we need to do to save the world, Katie?
Well, a lot. And we need to stop doing so many of the things that we're currently doing, which is actually not quite the tall order that it seems to be. But we have a lot of preconceptions that stand in the way of that.
It brings me to a book that I read a while ago, and we did an interview with one of the authors, Mark Diesendorf and Rod Taylor. They wrote a book called The Path to a Sustainable Civilization, which I haven't had a chance to read before the show today properly, and I'm going to give a bit of a summary on it next week. But what became apparent, just having a quick look at it, was that having a market-driven, a profit-driven economy that requires growth is the problem. That's what causes the unsustainability of the current economic model. To address the crisis that's forthcoming, we need to enter a degrowth mode where we stop ripping stuff up and trying to sell it for profit. It has to be government orientated. There has to be central coordination around this through governments and through organisations like the UN, etc., which are giving direction to a whole host of nations and countries and entities that are cooperating and agreeing. This is the sort of path that needs to happen, but it doesn't look like we're anywhere near that kind of situation because we're stuck in this pattern of just growth and profit and growth and profit, and the people who are controlling the decisions are driven by that model.
Yeah. As I was saying last week, last episode, it's not so much the problem is an ideology called capitalism. It's that whatever ideology the world adopts seems to be one that's been pre-approved by capitalists, and they've been able to manage skipping from one sort of quite wrenching social change to another without actually suffering in any way. So, you know, they can go from classical liberalism of the early Enlightenment through the first industrial revolution, which is Adam Smith and all these people talking about the wonderful miracle of the market and how these things are sort of naturally occurring phenomena, and if we just let the entrepreneurial spirit guide it, everything will be fine, which then gets again reviewed in at the time of the second industrial revolution, where the needs of capital are more centered around large scale industrial production, which requires a new ideology, which is liberalism plus neoclassical economics.
And that's kind of like where we are at the moment. And so this was all theory back when they were talking about it, but now it's practice. Now we live in a world where markets do rule the economy, and that there are certain individuals with too much power who are controlling all the levers, who put people like Trump into the driving seat, but they'll put him in, they'll take him out. And people, you know, get confused. I think that Trump's a problem. Trump's just the latest face. I'm going to play something. This is by something I heard on Substack by Professor Jeffrey Sachs. I'll just let it speak for itself. Have a listen to this.
The 10 richest Americans have $2.3 trillion of wealth. That's a lot for 10 people, 10 individuals. That's not 10 companies. That's not 10 clans. That's 10 people. But they also happen to own a lot more. They own the White House. They installed the vice president. They determine U.S. government policy. They will own the cryptocurrencies, which will become our main currencies. They own all of the big platforms on which we communicate. They own YouTube, of course, which is the channel where I'm able to say sometimes things that are not in the U.S. government's liking, but I don't know for how long. They own my email address. They own the full knowledge of every keystroke I've made in the last 10 years, no doubt. They own my privacy. They own the newspapers like the Washington Post, owned by Jeffrey Bezos. They will own TikTok shortly, TikTok USA, because Larry Ellison is buying it on behalf of Benjamin Netanyahu, and Ellison will give it to his son as a nice gift. He's already given to his son Paramount Studios, Paramount Media, and CBS News. It's quite a world, and that's just 10 or so Americans. So we're in a very strange concentration of power, I think the likes of which we've never seen before. It has already destroyed democracy. We are democratic in form only, but we don't have a sensible non-democratic system. We have a privatized system, which is quite different. In China, which is not a democracy, it is a technocracy. In the United States, it's the other way around, which is the government is subordinate to the particular corporate class now of the big tech sector. So we're in a governance adventure as well. Will there be general well-being? Depends on how we use our surplus. If all the surplus goes to the top, then we will have mass impoverishment.
So that's Professor Jeffrey Sachs. I don't agree with everything he says. His idea that cryptocurrency will become the new currency, I am skeptical of. But a lot of what he says rings true. And that last comment, we were talking about this before. About the surplus going to where the surplus goes, and I was a little bit confused because from an MMT perspective, I was thinking, is he talking about the private sector surplus, But what was your take on that?
No, I think he's got more of a classical and neoclassical sort of view of the world, and he sees the market as a naturally occurring phenomena, and capitalism as just the expression of an innate human entrepreneurial spirit, and the workings of entrepreneurialism and market relations generate a surplus over and above the what's required just to keep society ticking over. So what he's saying is that the surplus is
The surplus value which in Marxian terms is, you know, a worker produces more output than they receive. They produce a surplus value, which ends up as profit, or just a surplus. Let's put it that way. And that surplus could be redirected back into the public good, or it could be channeled into profit for private entrepreneurs.
Which is a very conventional way of looking at things. This guy is very, very mainstream, even if he's being quite a dissenter. But what we're actually looking at now is a system where the surplus is designed in. It's baked into the operation of markets. Firms do not engage in any sort of activity that isn't going to earn them the surplus that they want. So the surplus is not a residual. The surplus is something that's planned by firms, and that's quite different to the 19th century view of the world, and it's a result very much of the neoliberal age, which came as a result of people looking at the post-World War II consensus and saying, "Eek, this is a slippery slope to communism." And this is, an existential threat to all that is good and decent.
And what we're seeing is that when you say it's baked into the system, we're seeing that these entities that take the profit have way too much influence and have now controlling government. If you're looking at neoliberalism from its pitch, it says that, look, the best way to distribute the resources in an economy is through private markets, because they'll find the natural balance and everybody will live happily ever after.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I think that is just a smokescreen for the people who understand that we want to control where the surplus goes. We want to capture as much of that as profit as we possibly can. This sounds lovely, so we'll put it out there. But
it goes a good bit further than that, because it's not just the change that has happened in the last 50 years has not just been a question of, we have a system that is the best and the most efficient and most socially just and equitable system for allocating resources and distributing the return on all the work that is done. It's a system that according to a guy called Philip Murawski, who's a big analyst of neoliberalism, it's a system that is it's an information processing machine. Markets are information processing machines. So any problem that you have can be solved by making a market. So this comes out of what we were talking about last week with the think tanks, starting with the Mont Pelerin Society in the 1940s, looking at the post-war consensus and thinking, "Eek, this is a problem."
Yeah, they're changing our model, where the capitalists had more control over where the money went, and they're seeing that slip into government hands, who are distributing it without their without their controls that they used to have. The Mont Pelerin Society, that was Friedrich Hayek, started that. Austrian? Was it the Austrian?
He was Austrian. He's not part of the Austrian School of Economics.
That's right.
Whole other thing. This is kicked off by guys who are like sincere, philosophically committed, true believers, but they're funded by capitalists who say, "Hey, this is a philosophy that is better than the post-war consensus. This is something we can get behind. This is something that can mitigate the risk that we are going to lose our privileged positions, which we have enjoyed for so long." So Hayek and his gang were quite on the outside after the war, because everybody's had the experience of the Great Depression and World War II, which kind of demonstrated that rational economic planning can work miracles and defeat fascism and all the rest of it. So they're on the outer. But in 1955, I believe it was, in the 50s anyway, Hayek's approached by an English businessman called Anthony Fisher, who had just been to the US, and he'd made his fortune by importing to the UK the US practice of battery chicken farming. So a lovely gentleman who you know, lover of
nature
and wildlife and all of that.
Cooks.
And he went to Hayek saying, "Hey, I want to help you. I'm going to launch my career in politics." And Hayek said, No, don't do that. That is a, you're on a losing thing there. He said, start a think tank instead.
Right. And he was the founder of what's known as the Atlas Network.
Yeah. The first think tank he set up was called the Institute of Economic Affairs, which sort of became the model for a whole lot of other think tanks that followed in America and so on. Eventually, by the early 80s, he was also responsible for setting up the Atlas Network.
I've done a bit of work through Wikipedia doing some research on the Atlas Network. So let me read to you from an abridged version of Wikipedia. It says that the Atlas Network, which the legal name is the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, is a non-government organization based in the United States that provides training, networking, and grants for libertarian, free market, and conservative groups around the world. Atlas Network was founded in 1981 by Anthony Fisher, our man, a British entrepreneur who was influenced by Austrian school economist Friedrich Hayek and his 1944 book, The Road to Serfdom. He wanted to connect various think tanks via a global network. Friedrich Hayek, Margaret Thatcher and Milton Friedman, all friends of Fisher, formally endorsed the organisation as a think tank that creates think tanks. The Atlas Network's think tank partners produce white papers, meet with politicos, liaise with the media, write legislation, and much, much more. Academic Karen Fish described the Atlas Network campaigns for deregulation and property rights as having so much influence that the World Bank's Doing Business Index follows exactly Atlas's policy recommendations. So they're influential, you know, and this is the problem. So tobacco and oil industry links. Atlas Network channeled funding from tobacco corporations to think tank actors to produce publications supportive of tobacco industry positions. The Atlas Network appears to have played a particular role in helping the tobacco industry oppose tobacco control measures in Latin America during the 1990s. Lovely people, you know. Mm. Let's bugger cancer, let's make a profit. Atlas Network and its partners, such as the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, Cato Institute and Fraser Institute, have been linked to oil and gas producers, as well as efforts opposing governments and activist efforts against climate change. Political ties. Atlas Network describes itself as non-partisan and does not get involved in campaigns or elections, but rather trains local think tanks on how to influence the public and policymakers. According to the ABC News Australia, Atlas Network partners are taught how to win the battle for hearts and minds. The Intercept, The Guardian and The New Republic have described Atlas Network as having ties to conservative movements, including the administration of Donald Trump in the United States, Brexit in the United Kingdom, anti-government protests in Latin America. Network partners were linked to an online campaign that used fake accounts against the Cuban government during the 2021 Cuban protests. The conservative lobby group Advance collaborated with fossil fuel companies and Atlas Network affiliates, the Centre for Independent Studies, the Institute of Public Affairs and Liberty Works to promote the No campaign in the 2023 Australian Indigenous Voice referendum. So they get in there, you know, and meddle with things. So training a network, Atlas Network has been described as a connector, putting freedom intellectuals and local think tanks in contact and financing their trips. The organisation offers training, consulting and professional certification related to fundraising, marketing, organisational leadership and think tank management through its Atlas Network Academy program. So what you can see here is they're getting in a fairly grassroots position. Like they're getting into... activists and training them up.
Yeah, they're evangelizing and they're working from the grassroots up. Yeah.
Financials. As a non-government organization, the Atlas Network receives donations from foundations, individuals, and corporations, but not government funding. Atlas Network has received funding from the Charles Koch Foundation, the Charles Koch Institute. Other donors include Donors Trust, Lind and Harry Bradley Foundation, the John Templeton Foundation, and the Lilly Endowment. Research by the activist website DeSmog said Atlas Network had received millions of dollars from Koch-affiliated groups, the Exxon Mobil Foundation, the Sarah Scaife Foundation. Of the Atlas Network partners, 57% in the US received funding from the tobacco industry between 1990 and 2000. Atlas Network said the corporate funding accounted for less than 2% of its total donations in 2020. National Review said in 2021 the fossil fuel and tobacco interests provided less than 1% of Atlas Network's funding over the two decades versus 98% from individuals and foundations. As of 2020, the Atlas Network had assets of $13,849,060, nearly $14 million. In 2023, the group received over $28 million from donors and gave out more than $7.6 million in grants to its partners. The Atlas Network grew to include many others, including those affiliated with the Koch family. The organization partners with nearly 600 organizations in over 100 countries. Notable partners of the Atlas Network include think tanks such as the Economic of Institute Affairs in the United Kingdom, that was Anthony Fraser's initial thing, the Cato Institute, the Manhattan Institute, Pacific Research Institute, the Heartland Institute, Goldwater Institute, Acton Institute in the United States, the Fraser Institute, McDonald Laurier Institute, Canadian Taxpayers Federation, Montreal Economic Institute, the American Legislative Exchange Council, Second Street in Canada, the Centre for Independent Studies in Australia, New Zealand Taxpayers Union, and the Heritage Foundation was a member until 2020. So the Koch brothers come up in this a lot. So I'm just going to a little quick description of the Koch brothers. So the Koch brothers, Charles and David Koch, sometimes referred to as the Koch brothers, have become famous for their financial and political influence in the United States with a libertarian political stance, particularly the libertarian conservative or right libertarian branch most commonly found in the American style of libertarianism. I think David's now dead, Charles is still alive. From around 2004 to 2019, with foresight and perseverance, the brothers organized like-minded, wealthy, libertarian-orientated conservatives, spent hundreds of millions of dollars of their own money to build an integrated and stealth network of their of think tanks, foundations, grassroots movements, academic programs, advocacy, legal groups to destroy the prevalent status paradigm and reshape public opinion to favour minimal government. The Koch brothers are the sons of Fred C. Koch, who died 1900 to 1967, so he was 67 years old, who founded Koch Industries, now the second largest privately held company in the United States. As of 2012, they owned 84% of Koch Industries stock, that's the Koch brothers. And as of December 2022, Charles Koch was estimated to have a net worth of $66 billion, making him the 14th richest person in the world. So when they say that they're not receiving money from oil and tobacco, they're receiving it from Charles Koch.
Yeah.
Who's providing it as an individual. But with $66 billion, you can be fairly generous with your donations and grants, etc. And so that's the kind of structure. That's a taste of it. There's more. There's a Heritage Foundation. There's the all sorts of the CPAC, which we'll get into later on. Mm. But this is the organisation between the people who end up making decisions and providing legislation, politicians, etc. It's a bit bit scary.
Yeah. And it's not like all you need is money to influence politics in this to this extraordinary degree. You need true believers. You need some sort of coherent philosophy to hang things on in order for people to be able to credibly, you know, be corrupt.
Yeah.
You know, you need a convincing story if you're going to do things that are counter to the interest of the bulk of the population. So a lot of these guys are, well, a lot of them obviously are just totally cynical, but a lot of them are true believers. And the difference between these guys and other free marketeers from times gone by is that these guys don't believe that markets are naturally occurring phenomena. that markets are machines that can solve any problem you throw at them. You just have to, if you have a social problem of any kind, you just have to create a market. But the machines require proper configuration and maintenance and fuel, and this is what government is for. So this is no longer just laissez-faire, government should get out of the way and just let nature take its course. This is, government should be actively intervening to create an environment where the market can work optimally.
So the government is working for the markets and particularly for the people that control the markets.
Yeah, you can say that. You can say that. But it's like, rather than the market just naturally occurring to work in service of society as a whole, the market knows what's best. It's not you coming to the market with a good idea. The market is telling you what's a good idea.
Okay.
And if you don't take the signals that the market is giving you, that's on you. That's your fault. So
when those markets, like the earlier sound clip that I provided, when those markets, the voice of those markets is controlled by the people who are making the profit from those markets, then the message you're being fed is going to be fairly directed towards their interests.
Yeah. But I mean, once you buy that story, then the role of human beings becomes totally different. I hate to cite Michel Foucault, but he came up with this idea of the entrepreneur of the self, which is that a human being is just a blank slate. There's just an amorphous collection of various curated attributes, marketable skills mainly. What makes up yourself is constantly responding to and refined by signals that you get from the market. So this is what you see on LinkedIn or Facebook or whatever, when people are cultivating a sort of picture of who they are, which is designed to make themselves more marketable. So the general idea is that when you believe all this, then unemployment isn't the government mismanaging the economy. It's the unemployed have a skills mismatch. They just don't have the skills that the market is demanding. They're too dim to pick up the market signals. And education just becomes an investment in human capital and nothing else. I left high school in 1988, the year of the Dawkins reforms to education in Australia, which really took that idea and ran with it. The idea that, free university education ended with that.
Yep.
And the idea that the sole purpose of education, I mean, maybe you might be independently wealthy or something and you're just doing it to entertain yourself, but otherwise the sole purpose of education is as an investment in future earnings capacity.
Which is a complete contrast to the Whitlam era of free education, which the Dawkins, and now I'm picking up on what you're saying here, the Dawkins focused education to knock out workers for corporations, essentially, to be able to for their models of profit to keep going. You compare that to the Whitlam years, where people could study anything because it was free, and you get all this cross-pollination of new ideas and things happening.
Yeah, and you know, this is a very old and very classically liberal idea that, you know, people like Bertrand Russell, so on and so forth. You know, education is about developing human potential in whatever way it might flourish. And then it's the job of government to look at the resources that they have at their disposal and make the most of it, which means, you know, you don't prescribe what people have to be. You just let them develop to their full potential, and then your job as government is to make use of that potential for social benefit. So this is a complete inversion. It's essentially dehumanizing.
Yeah,
and as Margaret Thatcher said, economics are the method. The object is to change the heart and soul. Like, if society's not functioning well enough, it's not a matter of the government failing to manage things or you know, the market mechanism somehow not being fit for purpose. It's the actual individuals that are at fault. And this is not the 19th century style laissez-faire, small state liberalism. You need a large and powerful state to discipline society and individuals and organisations and institutions such that they are responsive to the market. The market is calling the shots. Everybody else must simply respond.
Yeah, and so here we see the state capture of government by industry and by capitalists. Dearie me. Well, I think we're going to have take a little break to ponder on some of that stuff. We'll come back and continue with this this shortly. But we'll see you in a little bit. You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT
at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia,
and wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
Nothing ever sticks to you. Not Velcro, not Scotch tape, not my arms dipped in glue. Not if I wrap myself in nylon, a piece of duct tape down my back. Love fears the arrow with the 12, and I can't get you back. An old Ford, they took off its wheels, the engine is gone. In its seat sits a box with a note that says, "Goodbye, Charlie, thanks a lot." I see a child through a window with a bib, and I think of us and what we almost did. The Hudson rocketing with light, the ships past the Statue of Liberty at night. They call it ecstasy, 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 ecstasy. Some men call me Saint Ivory, some call me Saint Maurice. I'm smooth as alabaster, with white veins running through my cheeks. A big stud through my eyebrow, a scar on my arm that says domain. I put it over the tattoo that contained your name. They called you ecstasy, ecstasy, ecstasy. They call you ecstasy. Passing through a cloud, a body facing up is floating towards a crowd. And I think of a time and what I couldn't do. I couldn't hold you close, I couldn't become you. They call you ecstasy. I can't hold you down, I can't hold you up. I feel like that car that I saw today. No radio, no engine, no hood. I'm going to the cafe. I hope they got music, and I hope that they can play. But if we have to part, I'll have a new sky right over my heart. I'll call it ecstasy. Oh, ecstasy, ecstasy, thank you.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are. At home, work, driving.
On public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your app.
You're on 3CR, Radio MMT, with Katie and Kev this week. I use the Community Radio Plus app. It's a little purple app that you put on your phone, and you can find all the community radio stations in the world and put your favourite ones in. So that's what I do, and 3CR's in there. It's a good thing to do. What were we talking about, Katie? Where are we? You're going to have to help me out today. I'm a bit brain fried this week, so you're going to have to help me out as much as you possibly can.
Okay, so we've got this community of true believers who have been on the policy outer for a while. Milton Friedman, one of the true believers from the University of Chicago, said in 1972, he said, only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. That, I believe, is our basic function, to develop alternatives to existing policies, to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes the politically inevitable.
I reckon we can learn from these guys, because what we're seeing here is they had a well researched and rehearsed program to apply in the oil shocks that happened in the 1970s. So when there was a disruption to the economy, they went, right, we've got the answer, here it is. It's brilliant, it's called the market, and we'll solve all your problems. And they were really well prepared. And the other thing I'm picking up from the way they operated is this kind of grassroots thing. Like all of these foundations they've got are funding people at a very local level to become vocal and well supported, etc. So I don't think a progressive movement can match the financial clout of the conservative movement, but some of the strategies that they're using are to have something which is very ready to go. And MMT is a very well organized economic platform. It's not a model; it's a platform. I've got to use your words carefully here, otherwise I get in trouble. Milton Friedman said that when a crisis arrives, you need to strike. That's the time to present your ideas.
Yeah.
Well, we've certainly got some crises arriving. They seem to be fairly well documented, and I guess that's where we get some hope from. Is that when the crisis arrives, the environmental crisis arrives, or the inequality crisis, or whatever crisis you want, the poly crisis. I'd like to think that we are in a position to say, "Here's some ideas, guys. How about it?" Is that our purpose?
Yeah. I think in terms of strategy, it works well, as it did in the 70s. So we have the oil crisis and all sorts of other things going on in the early 70s, which caused problems. And it was the first, there were a couple of recessions through the 1960s, which was like the first chink in the armour of the old consensus. But by the mid to late 70s, it's like, This is the neoliberals' time to shine. So there was a very influential report prepared for the OECD in 1977. I won't give you the full title because I can't remember it, but it's colloquially known as the McCracken Report, named after Paul McCracken, who was Nixon's chair of the Council of Economic Advisers. Also went on to work for Reagan, unsurprisingly. Mm-hmm. He led the committee that wrote this report in 1977 for the OECD, the rich country club, and they basically said that the cause of the problem was not the oil crisis, it was not the food crisis of 1972 onwards, it was none of those things to do with the real world. It was all to do with excessive government spending, which was caused by an excess of accountability to the population. It was an excess of democracy, basically, and too much regulation and so forth, which he said constituted an administered inflation, was his term. And so the assumption was that basically because private investment drives prosperity, public investment drains it. This is all just based on gut feeling. He doesn't produce any evidence. But what it comes down to is wherever there's a disjuncture of interest between democracy and capitalism, it's capitalism that must win out at all times.
And you see government sort of rolling over and just accepting these terms and conditions that are placed upon them by these neoliberal influences, shall we say. I've been reading a book for quite some time, which is called The Hawk Keating Hijack, and it's written by a fellow called Dean Jantsch, J-A-E-N-S-C-H. How do you pronounce that? I don't know. And it's a bit of a laborious book to read because it was just basically about the Labor Party machine and how it works. But towards the end, it became quite interesting. So this puts some context around how government, particularly the Labor government, has changed from being, say, a workers' party to an electable party. It talks about its electoralism. To that end, it's accommodating a lot of capitalist influences. But there was a section which I was reading. There's a few bits here which I'm going to read out to you. So it says, electoralism demands that a political party be cautious. It seeks to instigate change only when it seems apparent that the electorate is at least not actively opposed to such a change. The party will also seek to be inoffensive, the catch-all emphasis. Any proposals for government action will be considered, even tested, to establish that negative reactions are minimal or can be immunised. Electoralism demands a passionless party, one willing and able to abandon causes, claims, appeals, policies, programs, if there is evidence that by pursuing them, votes may be lost. It can be described as a cynical party, committed to no cause unless the majority of the electorate seems to also be so. It also needs an image of being safe. There is an essential conservatism built into electoralism. A safe party will produce an image designed to scare or worry as few as possible, and a policy set which moves only slowly and then along carefully tested lines. The party can have a vision, but this needs to be painted through the eyes of the electorate. And so I guess the point that I'm trying to make here is that we see a party like the Labor Party, which started off with a real reason to be, which was for workers, and it then becomes something which appeases the electorate, and that electorate is being dominated by capitalist influences. And so you see the Labor Party rolling over to making itself hard to differentiate from its competitor, which was the Liberal Party or the Coalition, who are very much in alignment with capital. And so Labor sort of goes, well, if we're going to win elections, that's what we have to do too. And now this was written in 1989, and it describes almost perfectly the current Albanese government. It's quite remarkable.
It is uncanny. And similarly, this report for the OECD in 1977 reads like a history of the Hawke and Keating government.
Right, okay.
Like 10 years before the fact. Also, it reads like the history of the New Zealand Labor government and Roger Nomix and all that sort of thing, and also the UK Labor government of Callaghan in the late 70s, just a couple of years later, then Thatcher and Major and Blair. And actually, this McCracken guy, he wrote a short paper in 78 where he was saying that actually the Callaghan government in Labor have done a brilliant thing by introducing all these reforms. And this may well have saved their political bacon at the next election. So he wrote this in 78. The winter of 78 and 79 was called the winter of discontent,
right,
which saw the biggest sort of, the first and of the anti-neoliberal protests that were to sweep England during the Thatcher years. But the Callaghan government was so reviled because of it that they lost the next election in 79 to Thatcher.
So it just took off. There's another interesting section out of this book which carries on from the previous theme, and this shows you the shift, particularly of the Labor Party. It's something along the same lines where, okay, so it says, one barrier to the full development of electoralism was removed in 1982 when the party's objective was totally rewritten to remove any semblance of anything that might be construed as socialist. the choice facing the majority of the conference who approved this and the minority who were determined that electoralism was heresy was encapsulated by Wilden, who said, if the ALP is to describe itself as socialist, it needs to develop socialist policies and to convince the electorate of their desirability. If the party is really in favour of private enterprise economy, the socialist title will only be lead in its saddle. The new objective removed the lead and allowed the Hawke-Keating revolution to begin, unencumbered by a doctrinal statement of the party's fundamental ideology. In its objective, it is clear since 1982 that the ALP in office is socialist only in the eyes of its most determinedly purblind opponents. So, you know, we can see here that that they've abandoned anything that that might be considered socialist, which means they're what, anti-socialist, which means they're capitalist. They're
well, if
transforming.
If you're going to be charitable, you'd probably say that both the Labour Party and the Liberal Party at this period became apolitical.
Yeah.
Because neoliberalism basically just says that the business of government is managing a system that basically runs itself and takes all the day-to-day decisions. And politicians love this because politicians hate politics more than anybody. So a solution to all their problems that takes the difficult choices out of it, while at the same time they can say, look, we're following all the rules, we're making the tough choices. This is just magical for them.
Yeah. There's a good description of the evolution of the Labor Party in this same book by Henry Gents. It says a case can be put that the Hawke-Keating hijack is merely the latest stage in a history of transformation of the Australian Labor Party. A case can be put that the Labor Party began as a socialist party in the 1890s, that it became Laborist by the 1920s, that it was transformed to Social Democrat under Whitlam, and that the final development to pragmatic electoralism was accomplished at the 1983 election of the Hawke government. From the left, however, the case assumes a different character, that the Hawke-Keating government is the culmination of a process during which Labor has abandoned its commitment to the people who are its true base, the workers, the dispossessed, the underclasses of a capitalist society. The left argues that policies of the government have out-liberaled the Liberal Party, and that consorting with millionaires is not a Labor approach, that the concentration on a deregulatory mode of economic policies, flirting with Thatcherist privatisation, and a concerted pitch for the middle class support, to mention only a few of the complaints, are not within Labor's traditions and are in some instances positively anti-Labor. And remember, this was written in 1989, and I was kind of unaware of just how much they'd abandoned their roots by that stage, because some of their social policies were pretty good, and Keating had a very sharp tongue and the rest of it. But
he was fantastically witty. I will never forget him saying that John Howard was a shiver looking for a spine to run up.
Some of the stuff, you can just imagine him lying in bed the night before thinking, what am I going to say tomorrow? And he'd work on a theme like that, and then he'd just drop it in there. He was...
But I mean, that's the other part of it. Politics just becomes theatre. It just becomes entertainment.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, during this whole thing, the Coalition and the Labor Party are trying to capture the same electorate with a variation on the same thing.
Yeah.
It's like, we're going to do it this way, they're going to do it that way. Which one do you like best? It's the same thing, really, but, you know.
It's the same hymn book. Who sings the hymn better?
Yeah. So I guess that's how we end up in this situation where we have capture of the political process by capital. It's left to run unchecked. It's driven by a profit-driven model that exists within boundaries that are being exceeded, and we're looking at a catastrophe, like I say, like a climate catastrophe or just a social catastrophe through inequality where things break down with all these pressures, with a population that's growing, a worldwide population that's growing year by year, consuming more and more resources. And we're looking at how this can be stopped. And we're seeing that the political process is captured by it. It's a worry. You know, the United Nations is ineffective because of the powers of veto, etc. And that's the kind of theme of the show that we're trying to explore here, is we know that there are crises about to that are happening in front of us, and we're just trying to figure out how do we fend them off. We know what needs to be done, but nobody seems willing or able to do it. It's a conundrum, Katie.
One of the difficult things about it is that given that the market, left to its own devices, comes up with the optimal solutions at all times.
Well, said, you're talking about what they say.
People must be disciplined into treating the market as giving them their marching orders and whatever they want from life or whatever kind of society they want to live in is immaterial. Like, democracy is over. This is just the raw fact of the market the market calls the shots now. It's our job to keep the market ticking over and to be steered by it, to follow the winds wherever the market is blowing. As you say, this is disastrous for the planet, because there's this global situation where we have like a worsening situation of global inequality, where the wealthy core countries are profiting at the expense of the poor periphery countries, which is the majority of countries in the world. Jason Hickel earlier this year put out a paper with some colleagues just quantifying the scale of this.
He's great, Hickel. I love his stuff. He's very, very, just very readable, very, it makes things very understandable. So what do you say?
He did some back-of-the-envelope sums which said that the rich countries since 1960 have drained $152 trillion worth of resources from the global south, which it's certainly true that certainly since the 70s and the IMF introducing structural adjustment programs, export-oriented development has meant that the poorer countries have not industrially developed their own domestic capacities at all. They've just been encouraged to compete against each other in the export of raw resources.
Diesendorf book that I was reading was describing saying, well, you know, who's to blame for the impacts on the environment? And he goes, well, everybody, except that the consumption of the global north, the footprint that they have left by exploiting the global south is enormously different, and that if we're going to address the issues of the impact on the environment, we have to look at what the global north is doing, how it's extracting stuff from the global south and destroying everything in its path in the name of profit. And even people who are putting solar panels in the global north, these rich people who set up their premises to be efficient and have minimal impact on the environment, to get to that stage to build the things that they need to be off the grid and to have their batteries and etc. still leaves an enormous footprint, which is provided by the global south.
Yeah.
They provide the resources for
it. And in the meantime, the core countries have deindustrialized, because that shifts the environmental cost to the poorer countries who take on more and more of the burden. Going back to 1977 and McCracken, he was saying, well, the answer is not regulation. The answer is a price mechanism, basically cap and trade. The producers will just add the cost of carbon to the price of the product, and ultimately the consumer, who's responsible for the use of the resources, will and the carbon emissions will end up paying. But that doesn't work in a case where the third world the developing countries are competing with each other and pushing the price down and down and down. They don't pass the price on to the rich countries, because they can't.
Anyway, look, we're running out of time, Katie, and you might wonder what you can do all about this. And we're going to take a lesson from the enemy to start at a grassroots level. So if you want to further discuss and figure out how to solve these problems, there's a Public Money, Public Good running a workshop in Geelong on Saturday the 5th of September. So it says, if you're in or around the Geelong region, we'd love to have you at How to Resist the Con on Saturday the 5th of September, the Public Money, Public Good workshop, How to Resist the Con, an interactive crash course on how to avoid being deceived by economists. Wages in decline, the cost of living rises, we hear that interest rates must rise, that public services must be cut. We hear so many economic myths embedded in everyday discussion. The con is everywhere. What is the truth? How to resist the con? Join us, join Public Money, Public Good for a collaborative workshop, Strategies for an Economic Self-Defense and How We Can Organize Together for the Quality of Life We Deserve. So it's on Saturday, the 5th of September, at the Geelong Library and Heritage Centre at 51 Little Mallop Street in Geelong. Go to the Public Money, Public Good website. Tickets are through Humanitix. It's free, but they'd like to register. Anyway, that's a good way to fight the system. But we've got to get out of here because Mafalda's coming up next. We'll catch you next time. See you later.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/Radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating the masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, yeah, no, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalent, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
We're going to do the regression theory of money to music.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.